7 p.m. at North Portland Eagles Lodge in Portland. The 8th Annual Inner City Blues Festival is a benefit for healthcare for all Oregon and features performances by the Norman Sylvester Review, the Richard Arnold Trio, the LaRonda Steele Band, and many more. KBOO will be broadcasting the festival on air. Again, that's the 8th Annual Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 27th from 5 to 11 p.m. at the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time now is 6 o'clock. Coming up next is Rising Up with Sonali.
Thank you so much for supporting KBOO during our recent spring membership drive.
Thank you.
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 We're really appreciative for all that you do to support your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Thanks.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government, offering a new master's degree in nonprofit leadership for those who believe in the power of collective action for social change. More information is available online at pdx.edu/Hatfield School.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, President Donald Trump is meeting with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on Friday at the White House. They will be joined by financial advisors from both nations to discuss a number of issues, including trade and economic ties in the energy and technology sectors. According to Bloomberg, the U.S. is pushing to reduce its trade deficit with Japan and gain better access to the Asian nation's agricultural market. And Japan is looking for a concrete promise that it won't be hit by possible tariffs on auto imports. High on the agenda will also be North Korea's denuclearization, a discussion that comes on the heels of a high-level meeting between Russia's Vladimir Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The Trump administration on Thursday released a plan to open up more than 1 million acres of public and private land to hydraulic fracturing in California. The lands being targeted cover several central California counties, including eastern Fresno, western Kern, Kings, Madera, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, Tulare, and Ventura. California has had a 5-year fracking moratorium on federal lands after a judge ruled for a pause in operations to better study the health and environmental impacts. Claire Lakewood, a senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, told the Los Angeles Times, "The Central Valley has some of the worst air quality in the nation, and we know fracking and drilling make air quality worse. The plan is expected to be blocked by lawsuits that environmental groups are already readying." President Trump addressed the annual NRA convention on Friday in Indianapolis, rewarding the lobby group with his presence, as he has done 4 times in the past. This year's conference comes at a time when multiple reports suggest that the NRA is politically weak. But Trump addressed the audience as if he were at an election campaign, warning of leftists wanting to take away their guns.
Far-left radicals in Congress,
want to take away your voice, your jobs, your rights, and they especially want to take away your guns. You know that. They want to take away your guns. You better get out there and vote. You better get out there and vote.
That's Trump on Friday addressing the NRA convention. Meanwhile, a federal judge on Friday sentenced Russian national Marina Butina to 18 months in prison for being an unregistered foreign agent of the Russian government. Butina had attempted to infiltrate the NRA and other conservative groups, apparently at the behest of a Russian government official. According to CNN, she is the first Russian citizen convicted of crimes relating to the 2016 election, though her efforts to infiltrate Republican circles appear to be separate from the Kremlin's sweeping election meddling campaign detailed in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report. Butina has already served 9 months while awaiting trial. Her lawyers had asked for her to be sentenced to time served. Hundreds of students and staffers at Cal State Los Angeles and UCLA were quarantined this week after Los Angeles County declared a measles emergency. According to the New York Times, those at risk of having contracted measles were given health officer orders, legal orders issued by county officials, to stay home and avoid contact with other people as much as possible. It was determined that earlier this month, a student who had been infected with measles attended classes at UCLA. The strong response underscores the infectiousness of the measles virus, which can spread to an unvaccinated person just by breathing the air of someone who has the disease, even hours later. Measles has been spreading around the country in large part because of the unfounded fears among those who believe that vaccines cause autism. Speaking to reporters on Friday morning, Trump was asked about the growing incidence of measles cases around the country, and this is what he said.
They have to get the shot. The vaccinations are so important. This is really going around now. They have to get their shot.
That's Trump on Friday urging Americans to be vaccinated against measles. The U.S. Commerce Department released figures on Friday suggesting that by conventional economic standards, the U.S. economy continues to grow, surpassing 3%. The pace of growth even surpassed most economists' expectations. Much of the growth was based on consumer spending, which was down last December and January. The report does indicate that business spending is still slow. President Trump, who had promised to oversee an economic growth of more than 3%, hailed the report and took credit for its results. The same day that former Vice President Joe Biden formally made his announcement to run for president in 2020, a woman deeply impacted by his actions spoke up. Professor Anita Hill, who testified against then-Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas, says she received a call from Biden ahead of his announcement. Biden had overseen the contentious televised 1991 hearing, and many hold him responsible for making decisions that helped confirm Thomas and humiliate Hill. Biden's campaign team disclosed that he had recently called Hill and expressed, quote, his regret for what she endured. But in an interview with the New York Times, she said, I cannot be satisfied by simply saying, I'm sorry for what happened to you. I will be satisfied when I know there is real change and real accountability and real purpose. Professor Hill also held Biden responsible for enabling the kind of contentious hearing that took place last year, when Christine Blasey Ford accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault. In immigration news, the Pentagon is expected to expand the role of the U.S. military at the southern border with Mexico. Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan has reportedly approved 300 waivers for troop interactions with migrants from the south. The Pentagon says it is responding to a request from Homeland Security for military lawyers, cooks, drivers, and other support personnel. Meanwhile, the U.S. has just charged an immigration judge in Massachusetts and a court officer for allowing an undocumented immigrant to escape their courtroom from ICE agents that were waiting to arrest him. Under Trump, ICE agents have routinely sought to arrest immigrants while they're in court, a practice that critics have denounced. And Judge Dana Sabra has just given the federal government a 6-month deadline to reunify thousands of immigrant children with their parents. Reports came to light earlier this year that the Trump administration separated many thousands more families than was initially known last year. The government had asked the judge for a 2-year period to reunify families. The Supreme Court in Kansas has just ruled against that state's 2015 anti-abortion law banning second trimester abortions. The justices, in making their rulings, wrote that, quote, the rights of personal autonomy means that state laws cannot violate the right to, quote, control one's own body, to assert bodily integrity, and to exercise self-determination. This right allows a woman to make her own decisions regarding her body, health, family formation, and family life, decisions that can include whether to continue a pregnancy. The ruling is expected to help legal cases against harsh anti-abortion laws in other states. And a judge in Texas has just ruled in favor of a Palestinian-American woman who was fired from her public school district job for refusing to sign a pledge not to boycott Israel. Bahia Amawi worked as a speech therapist in a Texas school district near Austin. And when she was fired for refusing to sign the Orwellian pledge, she sued on the grounds of her First Amendment rights. The judge's ruling is the third such decision on anti-BDS policies around the U.S. BDS stands for the Movement to Boycott, Divest, and Sanction Israel over its human rights violations of Palestinians. And that does it for our news headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Amnesty International released a major report on Thursday about U.S.-led massacres of more than 1,600 civilians in Raqqa, Syria, from June to October of 2017. The report, entitled Rhetoric versus Reality in the War in Raqqa, found that the U.S. and its allies bombed the city indiscriminately in order to oust the Islamic State. Whole families were wiped out, and the U.S. has yet to acknowledge its role or the extent of the loss of life. And then earlier in the week, a new UN report on the Afghanistan war concluded that U.S.-backed Afghan government forces, along with U.S. and other foreign troops, were responsible for killing more Afghan civilians in the first 3 months of this year than the Taliban and other insurgent groups. And on Tuesday, U.S. ally and weapons buyer Saudi Arabia beheaded 37 of its citizens in a mass execution for what it called terrorism-related crimes. AP reported that the Saudis' medieval-style justice included publicly pinning one of the bodies and its severed head to a pole as a warning to others. Saudi Arabia continues to bombard neighboring Yemen with U.S.-bought weapons and U.S. military advice. Joining me to analyze the surge in death and destruction by U.S. hands under President Trump is Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome, Corey.
Thank you.
So this report by Amnesty in Syria, I wanted to start with that first. I mean, it's sort of hard to know where to start. The reports about the U.S. being responsible directly or indirectly for mass death and destruction in all these countries is so varied that we can start with the largest number of casualties for 1,600 civilians, as per Amnesty International, killed over the span of several months in Raqqa, Syria, as the U.S. was bombarding this city. What were your initial impressions of this report and its importance?
Right. Well, my initial response was, yeah, this is just the horror of what the U.S. has done in Raqqa and what the U.S. has denied doing. I was also, I must say, very impressed with how comprehensive the report is and the kind of methodologies that Amnesty and their collaborators in Air Wars employed were really quite impressive for painting this important and very dark picture of what the United States did and is doing. And the last thing is just that this is really one example of the U.S.'s ongoing so-called war on terror, which has been carrying out for over 17 years now, and which it has largely rendered invisible. But it continues in country after country around the world. And here we have a glimpse of what it looked like in Raqqa.
Now, this particular report, I thought also very importantly juxtaposed the U.S. rhetoric with the reality on the ground. So the U.S. Spokespeople, military spokespeople, literally claimed there were no responsibilities. So, for example, the report quoted Lieutenant General Stephen J. Townsend, who said, "I challenge anyone to find a more precise air campaign in the history of warfare. The coalition's goal is always for zero human casualties." I mean, so they literally haven't acknowledged a single death?
Right. I mean, it's simply false. And it's really important, actually, to talk about that, because that rhetoric is so important to the whole U.S. way of war making in general, and the way that the United States represents itself on the world stage. And certainly for those of us who live inside of the United States, what we hear is that the United States, this is the force for good around the world, and that unlike the enemies that the U.S. fights, the U.S. takes great pains to avoid civilian casualties. That is the kind of rhetoric that characterizes U.S. war making in general, but it has a particular role in the so-called war on terror, which counterposes the idea of these terrorists who are attacking civilians indiscriminately to the United States, which employs all of these efforts, including surgical and precision methods of aerial attack to make sure that they're killing only terrorists. And it's simply false. I mean, the very nature of an air campaign over a city as densely populated as Raqqa means that civilian casualties are going to occur. And the United States knows that. And that's happened in cities all across the world where the U.S. is carrying out this war.
Right. So essentially, the U.S., when dropping these bombs, there's no way that you would be avoiding civilian casualties. And of course, where the civilians in Raqqa were concerned, they were prevented from leaving, at least that's what the report suggests, by the Islamic State on the ground, a fact that the U.S. and its allies should have known as it bombarded this city for months from June to October of 2017, right? There were, you know, 10 people killed one day, 15 another day, whole families wiped out. But ultimately, the what the U.S. was saying in its bombardment of Raqqa was that it was going in there to help civilians, right? To save these trapped civilians from the Islamic State alongside the goal of wiping out the Islamic State. I mean, that's what some of the survivors told Amnesty. We were supposed to be the ones the U.S. was protecting. Instead, it was killing us.
Right, right. I mean, it's false on so many levels. I mean, first of all, with the most basic knowledge of what ISIS was doing in Raqqa, we know that civilians were not allowed to leave by the way that ISIS was ruling that place. And so we know that civilians were kept captive in the city. The United States knew that. So that's one thing. But the other thing, it's very important that Amnesty and Air Wars have documented what was really an aerial attack on a captive civilian population. But it's also worth looking at what the United States has done since, which also points to the fact that it absolutely is not, the purpose, the objective was not to save or help civilians in Raqqa. So the fact that there has been no reconstruction, this has been documented by journalists like Lama Al-Arian and Ruth Sherlock, have pointed out that in the years since this massive bombing campaign, there has not been the reconstruction which the United States promised would take place afterward. In addition to all of the things that the United States has done to prevent Syrian refugees from leaving Syria, that is, we know that the U.S. has done so much to prevent Syrians from entering the United States, but in terms of the funding that it's given to allies like Jordan, which neighbors Syria, for example, it also prevents Syrians from leaving. And so in many, many ways, the United States has shown that it's absolutely not only disinterested in the lives of civilians, but really treats them with utter contempt. It It subjects them to incredible violence at every step, from the air campaigns that the U.S. carries out to its failure or its disinterest in rebuilding their cities after destroying them, to confining people to Syria once they try to leave.
Right. The coalition has admitted that it killed 159 civilians. Amnesty found 1,600, so a tenfold difference. And the other thing that the report pointed out was that the coalition, the U.S.-led coalition, could have taken even minimal steps to reduce casualties and didn't. For example, they could have had some surveillance before launching their strikes to prevent this many civilian casualties. I mean, to me, this suggests that the civilian casualties was not something that the U.S. was even trying to avoid. I mean, what does that mean? You know, when we think about the terrorist attacks that just took place in Sri Lanka, where more than 300 people were killed, how is the U.S.'s action in Raqqa any different from those terrorist attacks, right?
Right. So it's a good question. And I think there are two things happening here. The first is the very notion that the United States could possibly and has the right to invade a country to identify and kill the so-called bad guys. That whole notion is just so wrong. The idea that the United States is able to distinguish between those who deserve to be killed and those who don't. Who gave the United States that authority? That's authority that the United States simply assumed. So the whole premise of this particular set of operations, but really the whole war on terror, that whole premise is wrong. The other thing that's worth saying is when we talk about questions of civilian casualties, and I think that Amnesty in particular has done very important work on this, the whole U.S. definition of what constitutes a civilian is something that it's really important to examine, because the fact is that the United States has operated in Syria, in Yemen, in Somalia, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere. It has operated such that it considers all males of a certain age in a certain area to be combatants, and therefore they can be subject to U.S. violence. And truthfully, the United States has carried out operations where it identifies particular areas where anybody within those areas can be a target. It, you know, is considered a combatant and therefore is defined out of the very idea of who constitutes a civilian. And so, you know, according to the U.S. logic, when they say, well, we've killed 500 terrorists, on one hand, which they said that they did in Somalia, you know, in Raqqa, similarly, they said, we've killed all of these ISIS members. So on one hand, they are just lying. It's simply false. And again, it's easily, I mean, if Amnesty International, which does not have the resources of the U.S. Department of Defense, is able to identify when children are being killed, then certainly the U.S. Department of Defense does, and they're choosing not to. But it's also the case that they consider certain people who live in certain areas to all be combatants, to all be terrorists, right, and so on. And so really, it's very important for us to say, to talk about that and really confront the racism that identifies people in majority Muslim countries, you know, people of color in certain areas in war zones, that says that these people are all subject to U.S. violence. That whole thing we have to challenge.
Let's turn to the other massacring of civilians that the U.S. has been engaging in, and that's in the longest official war the U.S. has ever waged, Afghanistan. So we've been supposedly waiting for results from ongoing peace talks between the U.S. and Taliban. Those talks have been going on for months, if not years. And the United Nations just released a report, just a day or two before the Syria Amnesty report, finding that pro-government forces, meaning the U.S.-backed government and the U.S. itself, caused more civilian deaths than even the Taliban and other insurgent groups. So hundreds of civilian killed, more of them killed by the U.S. Should we consider this part of the same negligence that the U.S. has fought the Syria war, that sort of callous indifference towards the lives of civilians?
Yeah, I think absolutely. This is, again, really part and parcel of the whole war on terror, and what you see are different versions of these same acts, that whether they're taking place in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Yemen, in Somalia, in Pakistan, et cetera. Now, on one hand, again, there's something that's disruptive that can be surprising, that lands in a surprising way about a report. When you hear the idea that the United States killed more people than the Taliban, there's something that's disruptive about that, because what we hear is that forces like the Taliban, forces like ISIS, et cetera, that these are the killers. These are the ones who have no regard for human life.
We're supposedly saving Afghans from these killers, right? Instead, we're killing them alongside the Taliban.
Right, exactly. Like on one, it's that the United States is supposed to be the defender. It casts itself as the defender of civilians against forces like the Taliban. But also, the United States is supposed to be operating along a different ethical code than the Taliban. That is, whereas the Taliban doesn't respect life, the United States does respect life. So that's why it can appear to be, there can be something disruptive about hearing a report like this, but it really shouldn't be surprising when you consider, again, I mean, when you consider the Taliban is using all kinds of horrendous methods of killing, including car bombs and improvised explosive devices, et cetera. The United States has aircraft and the whole arsenal of the U.S. military, which it is using itself and then arming the Afghan government's military with as well, which are, it makes sense that that would be more destructive. It's also the case that there is just at this point a long history, even the recent history of what the U.S. has done in Afghanistan since 2001, 2002, has been horrendous. In 2015, when it bombed a Doctors Without Borders hospital, for example, a crime for which nobody in the U.S., none of the personnel involved in that attack were held accountable. So this is horrendous, it's inexcusable, but it is also really the latest act of violence in what has been a whole string of violence that continues as long as the United States continues its occupation of Afghanistan.
Let's turn to Saudi Arabia. Of course, this isn't a country where the U.S. is directly dropping bombs, but it's working with Saudis to drop bombs on Yemen. However, the news that just emerged was the set of mass beheadings that the U.S. weapons buyer and strong ally Saudi Arabia engaged in, 37 people killed, executed by the government for so-called terrorism-related crimes. Among them, I believe, was one young person who was executed for having attended a few pro-democracy demonstrations in the past. He was scheduled to start university in the United States as a student. He was among those killed. I mean, if any other country that the U.S., you know, just picture if Venezuela had carried out such mass beheadings, this would be something that Mike Pompeo would be standing up on his podium at the State Department and denouncing and using as a basis for more sanctions, right?
Right. Well, I mean, for me, the really obvious contrast is always Iran, which is also like an Islamic, also an Islamic government, which the United States demonizes routinely, which the United States has imposed the target, not the Iranian government, but the Iranian population. The United States claims that Iran is the sponsor of terror, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And recently put on the terrorist watch list the Iranian National Guard, right?
Right, exactly. Because of, and this is, you know, it's true that the Iranian government has horrendous human rights abuses. But Saudi Arabia is you know, right next door, also carrying out these horrific abuses with the absolute support, really at every level, by the United States. Diplomatic support in terms of actually supplying the weapons, and that includes Saudi Arabia's crimes that it commits within the kingdom. That includes what it's doing in Yemen with extensive cooperation by the United States. And of course, we've seen all kinds of protection for years and years over throughout several many U.S. presidential administrations. But Trump, as he often does, makes it so naked the U.S.'s embrace of Saudi violence. It's also worth saying that you know, Saudi Arabia, which has the death penalty, in that sense, it is in the same club as the United States, one of the minority governments in the world that still have the death penalty. So, in a way, it's not terribly surprising that the United States is willing to look the other way and indeed provide diplomatic and all kinds of other material support to Saudi Arabia for its crimes, when the United States is not only working with Saudi Arabia in hand in hand in committing its crimes in the Middle East, but the United States itself is carrying out human rights abuses here.
And then the Yemen bombing, of course, continues. President Trump just, of course, vetoed a resolution that passed both houses of Congress on the ending U.S. support to the Yemen war. And of course, the excuse that the Trump administration and Trump himself has given is that, you know, if this is so that we can sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. It's very lucrative for the U.S. If they don't buy weapons from us, they'd buy them from elsewhere. But it's not that easy. The Intercept just had a report a few weeks ago about how the primary weapons that that Saudi Arabia is using in Yemen are U.S.-bought weapons. And if the U.S. were to cut off weapons, sales, it would take years for Saudi Arabia to replenish it from elsewhere and to switch weapon systems. So we're absolutely enabling that war, right?
Oh, at every turn, not only with the incredible sale of weapon systems, and what it means that Saudi Arabia, really any client of the United States and its weapon systems, you know, they want these, they build these relationships such that Saudi Arabia is buying weapon systems that are only compatible with other U.S. weapon systems. Their whole military kind of apparatus is really based on these decades of hardware that's sold by the United States. But it's also the case that in its war in Yemen, the United States is supplying intelligence to Saudi Arabia. The United States has been carrying out this mid-air refueling operation to fuel Saudi aircraft, which are also sold by the United States. And the United States has its own personnel on the ground in Yemen as well. So the United States and Saudi Arabia and the UAE are absolutely working hand in hand. And this is, it's so important because, again, it goes back to cutting through the rhetoric. The United States on one hand says that it opposes terror, it opposes violence against civilians, and that's why it opposes, you know, with these other forces that declares its enemies as. But Saudi Arabia is doing really quite brazenly the very things that abusing human rights in the very ways that the United States claims to oppose. And what that reveals is that the United States is not invested in human rights at all. Rather, the United States is invested in its own power. And Saudi Arabia is a staunch ally in that power. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia have convergent interests in the kind of Middle East and the kind of world that they want to see.
I'm wondering, Corey, if you think it's fair to say that there is very little appetite left within the United States for the kind of death and destruction that is being wrought in all of these countries, thanks to the United States. But it's just that we're feeling so inundated with the domestic attacks by the Trump administration that we're distracted from the violence and the mayhem that you know is happening. And yet, of course, when the media cover massacres committed at other hands, all eyes are on it. You know, when there are attacks by groups in Paris, or as we saw in Christchurch, New Zealand, or as we saw in Sri Lanka, there is an inordinate amount of sympathy and sympathetic outpouring and press attention, and just not that same level of attention to the victims of our direct policies, even though it's not something that the U.S. public really wants.
Yeah, you know, I think that the question of why there isn't more of a visible opposition to what the U.S. is doing here and what the U.S. is supporting is a really important question. And I think that you're right that you get at, it's actually, there's a, the answer is a bit complex, because on one hand, it's true. It's not the case that Americans are calling for more invasions and military operations. But on the other hand, there is the fact that the U.S. way of making war since 2001 has taken great pains to reduce the number of U.S. casualties, right, and then minimize in terms of what we see here those casualties that do occur. And so things like the drone war, things like the use of special operations, and so on, as opposed to conventional forces or using special operations more extensively. That means that we see very few Americans actually getting killed. We know that when the U.S. invaded Iraq, that they made a deliberate choice that when U.S. soldiers were killed, that the coffins would not be broadcast in the media. The mainstream media complied with that, request by the Bush administration. And that's the other piece, is the way, as you point out, how the mainstream media are covering this. We have heard about when there are high-profile, horrific attacks by the Taliban in Afghanistan. But we have not heard about, in the U.S. mainstream media, all of the attacks the United States has committed. And that is why it is so jarring when you hear that the U.S. has committed these massacres, when you hear that the United States is killing more civilians in Afghanistan than the Taliban is, and so on. It's so surprising because there's been so little coverage by the mainstream media of all of that killing. And so I do think that it's important when reports come out like this, that on shows like yours, and for those of us who are activists, we have a role to play in terms of highlighting what exactly the United States is doing.
It will come to haunt us in the end, as these wars have always come back. Corey, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest has been Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been discussing the results of Trump's foreign policy in nations like Syria, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and more. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Since April 15th of this year, the group calling itself Extinction Rebellion has been leading actions all over London, bringing the city to a standstill. Tens of thousands of activists, spurred by a sense of urgency on climate change that their politicians are simply not feeling, have occupied major landmarks across the city. They have glued themselves to trains and other structures, to each other in blocking entrances. They've engaged in mass non-violent civil disobedience, blocking roads and bridges. They've donned colorful costumes, paraded with large puppets and banners, and done everything they can to push political elites to respond to our climate emergency. What impact has Extinction Rebellion had? And how long will it continue? And how can U.S. activists replicate such climate activism? We go now to London to speak with Motir Rahman, member of the political strategy and vision sensing teams for Extinction Rebellion. Welcome, Motir.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you very much for the interview.
So give us an overview of what exactly has been happening since April 15th. I understand that there were four or five major landmarks across London, such as Marble Arch and Piccadilly Circus, that that activists decided to occupy, sort of like the Occupy movement that happened many years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's been planned for a few months now. There was a test occupation, you could say, or a test move in November when the declaration was made, the Extinction Rebellion Declaration, at Parliament Square at the end of October, and there was an occupation of five bridges there, and that was to test, in a way, the police response and how the strategy of non-violent direct action, how that would play out. And it was so successful in terms of that, how people came to that, and then also set up lots of local groups, that it brought the energy to really build towards the April the 15th rebellion and the occupation of four sites, to really bring the strategy to into its fruition, which was there's a book called This Is an Uprising by Engler, Mark Engler, and a lot of the Extinction Rebellion strategy is based upon that, the theory of non-violent civil disobedience, which is set out in that book about how that actually creates social movements and social change.
So the activism, I understand, also took on some specific targets. For example, on Thursday, there was a focus on financial institutions and how they are enabling our climate catastrophe to continue. So activists glued themselves to one another, blocking off the London Stock Exchange, among other actions. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I heard when you were introducing it about how New York or the US could replicate what happened in the UK. And the first stage, in a way, was to occupy these, or to occupy the roads at four sites that would have created that dilemma situation for the government, in a way, of blocking at Oxford Circus, at Waterloo Bridge, at Marble Arch, and Parliament Square. So four sites and four corners, which then created that economic disruption of sufficient level for the government then to have a dilemma as to whether to mass arrest everybody or to allow the economic disruption to happen. And then following on from those occupations, also to have these, as you say, these satellite actions as well to highlight specific issues, say with the transport or with also at the financial district as well. So to highlight how those are also complicit.
Now, I want to ask you a question that has been a sort of a weird side question, but I've been imagining what this must have felt like. People are gluing themselves to windows of trains, gluing themselves to one another using super glue. I imagine that the extrication is quite painful. This isn't the same as, you know, handcuffing oneself to somebody else. Gluing your skin. Tell me a little bit about that and how people are willing to risk their own sort of, you know, physical self in this climate emergency.
Yeah, I mean, the actual liquid or to get it's only warm water and some sort of solvent, so it's not, it takes time to get it off slowly. Yeah, it's not as painful as it seems. I wish it was gluing one's hand to it, so long as it's not ripped off. But, you know, so that's the point of it, to keep, you know, to have that you're glued on, and the police to take those to take its public duties into account in terms of and how they extricate yourself from that situation.
So what has the police response been? I understand that, you know, they've been over 1,000 arrests. I imagine that the number is really climbing every day, and it's the largest number of arrests in London around a single set of actions ever.
Yeah, I mean, I can't compare it to, say, for example, in with Gandhi or India, or how those times, but in modern times, I think it's one of the largest numbers of arrests for non-violent civil disobedience, and that is part of the theory that Roger Hallam, who's one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, he was doing his research at, on a PhD, looking at how nonviolent civil disobedience has led to social change. And one of the factors was the number of arrests and the amount of public support that is behind that. And so those are two key factors to create that change. And so we've had over 1,000 arrests. The police response has been, we've been very transparent with the police to tell them, you know, what we're doing. We've been transparent with the emergency services so that they can create alternative routes, so not to put lives in danger. So that is a huge part of the movement of non-violence, that we are very open with the police. And I think because I've been in communication with some, a little bit with the international movement, and there have been different, in different countries, there are different senses of how to respond and interact with the police. Each country has a different reaction to that.
Right, I should mention that this is an international movement, although its epicenter is in London, and its birthplace, I understand, has been in London. What sort of people have come out? Because, of course, as is the case in any such mass action, you have your core organizers, and then you have members of the general public who are mobilized, who find out about it, who feel so moved that they come out. I mean, photographs and videos from London show people of all ages participating. So can you give us a sense of who has been part of this movement?
I mean, I came to this movement after taking part in the in part of the huge part of the culture is a regenerative culture as well, of bringing into the groups who take part in super gluing themselves, etc., that there are members in their group that look after the regenerative aspects, making sure that there's somebody with them that goes to the police station. And the organizing of Extinction Rebellion has been very open as well, so it's decentralized, so new people can join in and take part in groups that are emerging and forming. So there are three main groups, you could say. There's the movement strategy, the action strategy, and the political strategy. And then within those, more circles like media and messaging, etc., that people can take part in. And I actually set up a Facebook, a Muslim Extinction Rebellion Facebook group, and I joined because I felt there was some, as being a Muslim as well, that there was a need for a positive contribution that Muslims could provide to the narrative of climate extinction and climate collapse. Mm. There are, as you say, more and more people from different sectors coming across. It's not just a middle class movement. It is to be a movement that is a social movement that meets everybody and marginalized people as well as with sort of the typical climate activist, you could say.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Muslims, London has its first Muslim mayor. How has Sadiq Khan been responding to what's happened in his city?
Well, the London Assembly was one of the first local government bodies to pass a motion for a climate and ecological emergency, a declaration for climate and ecological emergency. There have been now over 70 local authorities which have declared a climate and ecological emergency, calling on the central government to release the funds to enable them to act on those declarations. And since the actual rebellion, there has been some, I mean, Sadiq Khan, of course, he's got his role with transport as well, so he wasn't so keen on the actions against Transport for London with the underground, but I would say generally there's been a positive sense from the London Assembly as to the reasons why these actions have been taken.
And by the way, I should mention there are now reports that a new Banksy art piece appeared in London as part of Extinction Rebellion. An image of a young girl holding up a sign with the symbol of it, or actually looks like she's planting a seedling into the ground. And the caption says, "From this moment, despair ends and tactics begin." How successful have these actions been so far? I understand that among the occupations that have been held was one that took place in front of Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. Have MPs been moving? Have people been acknowledging the extent of the crisis? The Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, I understand, spoke to MPs as well during this whole series of actions. Have they shown a changing of their minds and shown some sense that they need to be taking this as seriously as you are?
I think there's definitely been a shift over the 2 weeks when the media was first reporting that it was more, who are you to disrupting ordinary people's lives? And then about halfway, as actually people began to see how the non-violence was at the heart of it and how creative the actions were, more and more people were joining in, the messaging began to change. And with Greta Thunberg particularly supporting Extinction Rebellion and seeing some of the leaders of the major political parties, there was that also created a huge shift. So Michael Gove, who's the Secretary of State for the Environment, has now agreed to meet with Extinction Rebellion next week. And there have been a lot of MPs actually have been coming out they came out on the Marble Arch stage. A few MPs came out onto that stage to declare their support. Some of the rebels went into Parliament to talk to their MPs, which was amazing to see the you know, that this space was being opened up in a way. And MPs, I think, liked to see their constituents. So that has created a change. There's been, I think, that kind of almost a tipping point into a place where we've opened up a space now where this conversation can actually can be had around climate, the actual emergency, and people and MPs and the media are beginning to take this seriously, as well as the business as well. So the CBI recently launched a business rebels or business declares an emergency platform as well. So this is having effect across multiple platforms.
Let's talk about the demands of Extinction Rebellion. There's just three, and they're very clear. And just as an aside, I remember during the time of the Occupy Wall Street movements here in the U.S., there was a little bit of a resistance to articulate clearly and simply and concisely a set of demands. But Extinction Rebellion has demanded that governments tell the truth about the ecological crisis, that you want zero emissions and drawdown by 2025. That's just over 5 years from now. And participatory democracy, setting up of a sort of assembly. Can you tell me a little bit about, the first one is clear, telling the truth about the ecological crisis, but this demand for zero emissions and drawdown by 2025, some would say is very radical and we can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's net zero by 2025. And that's an ambitious target. Yes, everyone would agree that's an ambitious target. But we have to go as ambitious as we can. And then if there's some, the Citizens Assembly is the key aspect, because that's the platform or the place at which these decisions will be made. So that rather than MPs making the decisions, it is a tried and tested method of a representative body of citizens selected by random selection. Rather than voting for them, and to reflect the demographics of the country, and then for that body to be making decisions. And that's what was used in Ireland, for example, when there was the question of the lifting of the ban on abortion, which was a very hot topic and no MP wanted to touch it. And then through the use of the Citizens' Assembly to come to a decision of deliberative democracy. So they were a bit like a grand jury, but much bigger, 100 people or so. Randomly selected, and they would then bring in the experts to answer particular questions, but they would remain with the mandate and the authority to make the final decision. And that mandate was trusted by the people because it was a randomly selected body. And so that democratic innovation, we think, is absolutely key and crucial to making the transition to a net zero carbon future. Mm.
So there is this sense that climate activists, of course, feel, you know, from attending the UN conferences, the COP meetings, that even if governments and political elites take seriously the emergency that we face, that the outcome ends up always being a plan to make a plan to someday reduce emissions. That's not enough, isn't it? Some among the messages that Extinction Rebellion has been making clear is that we have 12 years to turn this around, and others say even less time. It's past time to make a plan to make a plan, right?
Definitely, definitely. No, yeah, it's just that report from the IPCC, the 1.5 degrees report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in October 2018 was a wake-up call that we have this short window in which to make the change. And when you think of it, if you think of it like, you know, we're on a trajectory this to climate collapse, you can almost see it as we need an emergency break to change the trajectory to one where life can sustain itself, or the potential for it to sustain itself at least can be enlarged. And it's that emergency break period which is absolutely key. And Christiana Figueres, I don't know, she recently came out of support. There's a YouTube video of her. She was the leader of the talks in Paris for the UN. And she's now come out in support of Extinction Rebellion, saying that that it's done a much needed task of bringing the message of the urgency to a wider audience, and that it's now a political commitment and that needs to happen to make this happen across the world. And that's what the Extinction Rebellion has tried to start and kickstart through its global and international movement. Mm-hmm. And we've got 30, I think it was 80 cities, over 30 countries which have taken action.
Although it doesn't seem as though the actions have been as news-breaking and radical and mass and at a mass level as they have been in London. So I want to ask you what advice you would give to those of us here in the United States, the wealthiest country in the world, the country that is the biggest country to have pulled out of the very modest and flawed Paris Accord, whose leader is intent on unleashing more fossil fuels in the world. What advice would you give? I mean, you have the advantage in London of living in a sort of a densely populated city where you can have a strategy like the one you did, but that wouldn't apply to, say, a city like Los Angeles, where we are based, right? I mean, it's you can do it on a local level, but to get the attention of politicians like Londoners have, what advice would you give?
I mean, we have in England the privilege of living in a country where democracy does actually work and where non-violence. We have the right to peaceful protest, and that is taken seriously. So people can superglue themselves to trains and or block roads, and expect the police to respond in a proportionate way. And I'm sure there are many other countries where that wouldn't necessarily happen. So they have to, you know, you have to take into account those cultural and legal differences as well. And I guess in the States they do. You know, you have similar laws. But at the heart of that is bringing this non-violence, that DNA, you could say, of how to feel it, to be it, to know that non-violence, satyagraha, that truth telling, and holding that one is willing to hold that sense and bring the government to bear on that. And the local groups as well was really key, of having many local groups set up since the November action, and to strengthen their local groups, the affinity groups, and to strengthen that ground base of support as well. So it may mean that other countries might take it a little longer, but we're hoping that other countries will come to the same place that we have in England as well, and we can strengthen each other in supporting each other to come to that. So this is just the first stage of a long, long struggle, you could say, because it is a huge struggle to bring to make this huge shift. And we've done the first step of bringing awareness to it, but now, as you say, it's about not just making another plan, it's about enacting the huge radical shifts that we are going to need to be able to survive together.
Right. And I want to, by the way, mention the book that you were talking about earlier by Mark Engler, This is an Uprising. We had interviewed Mark about that book in 2016, and we'll link to that interview from the post where we put your interview on our website so that people can listen to that broader idea that that has informed the work that you've done. Thank you so much for joining us today. And give out a website for Extinction Rebellion.
It's rebellion.org.
That's rebellion.earth. Simple, really. Thank you so much for joining us, Mathir.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for listening.
My guest has been Mathir Rahman, member of the political strategy and vision sensing teams for Extinction Rebellion. We've been discussing how XR has brought London to a standstill over the climate emergency. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.
Rising Up with
Sonali. Spent most of my life in prison.
Criminal records can prevent individuals from moving forward with their lives, particularly with employment and housing. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on April 29th as we discuss how to get your criminal record expunged. That's Prison Pipeline, April 29th at 6:30 p.m.
Now I'm free. Now I'm free.
KVU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Wolf at the Door, a grim Latino fairy tale produced by the Milagro Theater in Portland every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from Thursday, May 2nd through May 26th. Deep in the woods, a young wife finds the strength to stand up to her abusive husband when he forces a pregnant woman to stay in their home against her will. This production is presented as a National New Play Network Rolling World premiere. Again, that's Wolf at the Door every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. from May 3rd through May 26th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 7 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Tonight on The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. It's an encore episode featuring her interview with Will Lang, director of Portland Jobs with Justice.
Hello to all of my friends. This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator.